You're really not an early morning person, are you, Ryan?
I'm not.
I'm not either.
Not remotely. I don't trust morning people.
Yeah, I properly don't understand people who wake up like, ping, ready to face the day.
It's because they're up to something.
Hello and welcome to Lexitecture, a podcast about word origins and histories. My name is Ryan, and in each episode, my friend Amy and I bring a new pair of words to share their stories with each other and you. You can find our past episodes and the occasional blog post on our website at lexitecture.com. Follow along with us on Twitter and Facebook at Lexitecture. And if you really like what we do, you can support the show at patreon.com/lexitecture.
Today's episode, Cleave to the Future. In the meantime, since we last recorded together and did one of these, we have had not one, not two, but three new Patreon sponsors. So people
Yay, we love those guys.
Onto things and giving us stuff. So one is my sister, Lindsay. Hello.
Woo! And mighty, mighty shout out for your incredible healthcare working baby sister, if I recall correctly.
That's true. That's the one, the healthcare working baby sister. The other one is
I should point out that as a baby sister myself, I hate being called baby sister. So apologies,
so
Lindsay. Shout out to the Ryan's awesome healthcare working ass kicking woman.
Fully formed sister. As a human being, sister, I guess. Yeah. If we must.
And in no way infantilized.
Yeah, exactly. there was a another one. I haven't heard back about permission and preferred names and stuff, so I'll just call him Ned because I love the name Ned. So thank you, Ned.
Oh, yes, Ned.
Also a listener from the Netherlands named Brian. And in our conversation about how to pronounce his name, he dubbed himself Brian von Swampnoise because he has a shockingly realistic understanding of how Dutch is received by most non-Dutch speaking listeners, but I believe his
Brian
last
von
name...
Swampnoise. Wow, we had so much fun discussing the emails from Brian von Swampnoise.
It was so good.
I salute your self-awareness and also awareness of how much other people are idiots.
Yeah, I believe his last name is van Bruggen, but I don't know if that's remotely true. But it's not. That's not the way I would have pronounced it, and I've already still pronounced it wrong. But he signed off his last demo with Brian von Swampnoise, so I feel like he's pretty chill. So, yes. So thank you to all new Patreon sponsors and all existing Patreon sponsors. And if you would like to be a new Patreon sponsor, patreon.com/lexitecture, and then yes, you will be one of the cool kids among an already cool kids crowd.
I don't know how I feel about that. You know, I was never like, even the kids who weren't the cool kids knew that I wasn't like, I was less than not cool. You know, the not cool kids looked down on me. I believe I may have been negative cool.
Were there people like us are there for the not cool kids to feel better about themselves?
Yeah, kind of.
That's our role in life. Anyway, yes, thank you for doing the last episode solo. I know that it sucks, but,
I'm still thanking Patreon
still
sponsors. You're like, thank you. So many thank yous. And it was very lovely to, receive the message that you sent me. One of our listeners, Daphne, I believe, tweeted to say, that although solo episodes are not as good as episodes with both of us, that she enjoyed the solo episode, and I was really stressed about it. So yeah, thank you very much. It meant a lot to receive a wee bit of feedback like that. As it does, and you know, it means a lot for us to receive any kind of feedback. So please, if you get upon an episode and think to yourself, well, that totally sucked, let us know. Yeah. Let us know why you think that was the case. Or if something is particularly delightful and fills your heart with honey, then let us know about that too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Would you like me to go first since you carried the whole weight of the world last time?
Well, I don't know. I think sitting the bar exam involves carrying a fair amount of weight.
Ugh, that's gross. I don't like them.
The bar exam, of which we shall never speak again until next time.
Until the next one I have to do in several weeks.
Yeah, I should point out, dear listener, I'm not implying that Ryan is sitting it again because he failed it. He just has a second exam to sit.
Yeah, there's two of them because one is not enough or something.
take it away.
Okay. So my word, speaking of emails and contact from listeners, shout out to Kathleen Moore for sending this one along through the emails. It's kind of cheating because it's sort of two words that people think is one word. And the word is cleave. And this is something that has occurred to me as well. And I kind of go, that's weird that cleave has these two it's like a contronym. It's got these two opposite meanings, right? It's got to stick together and to split apart. So that's bizarre. It turns out there are two completely separate words that just look like each other.
No way.
Yeah, it's neat.
That's awesome.
They're two very old words, and they're from, I can imagine, an old High German, you know, 4th century version of a podcast, which I think is just called Talking, discussing how these words were similar then as well. But they're both very old. The sense of split or divide goes back to about 1100. And the first sense in the OED is defined as to part or divide by a cutting blow, to hew asunder, to split, properly used of parting wood or the like along the grain, i.e. between its parallel fibers, hence of dividing anything in the direction of its length, height, or depth, also of dividing slate or...
Not enough things. Sorry, on you go.
Keep going. Also of dividing slate or crystals along their cleavage planes and other things at their joints. I just liked that definition, so I decided to read the whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. What I was going to say, as I so rudely interrupted, was I feel like more things should be hewn asunder.
Oh, yeah. To hew asunder
both
is a
of
fantastic
those words,
phrase.
Both of those words, yeah, they need a little bit more of our attention. Hewn asunder.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, that's a very beautiful definition. And I had never considered the sense of splitting apart, but along lines that already allow us to split things apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting to me, which is why I decided to go for the whole thing. And there were minor variations of senses and broadenings and stuff. And like, so it didn't necessarily stick to that. It didn't necessarily cleave to that definition, but see what I did there? But it always meant to split up or to break or divide or whatever. So the sense of, as in stick to or like put/hold together or whatever, that one's even older. And it goes back to the end of the 9th century. So the good old King Alfred in, I think it's 897 or something. And it's to stick fast or adhere to as by a glutinous surface. And glutinous is just such a fun word anyway that I also had to read that one. So the OED knocking it out of the park with these definitions. It always had a figurative use as well. Like it was always metaphorical as well as physical. So cleaving was to stick to it as glue or other glutinous. But also just, you know, the grasping onto, metaphorically sticking to. And then it had a broader sense of holding onto or attaching oneself to by kind of the 1300s. But again, pretty resilient sense of the word. It's obviously used much less in that sense now. So the younger split-divide sense is the one that comes first in the OED because it's most frequent. It's basically less obsolete than the idea of cleave.
People are so fickle.
So fickle.
You know, this Johnny-come-lately word comes dancing into existence in, you know, the 12th century, and now all the kids are doing it.
Crazy. A little stupid 900-year-old upstart. Pshaw. So as far as their etymologies go, because I guess we might as well talk about that, I suppose.
Ah, go on. Why not?
The sticking to sense, the older one, comes from an old German word, Kliffan. And before that, ultimately from Old High German. Now, Edom Online posits, like says, that some sources point to a Pi root of sort of a gloi, G-L-O-I. The okay. American Heritage Dictionary appendix of Pi roots. And the Pi etymology dictionary that you passed along, Porconi or whatever it is, neither of those sources have gloi as a Pi root. But the OED, which doesn't normally get into a really deep into the etymology of stuff and doesn't really get into Pi roots mm-hmm. at all, it kind of agrees that there might have been this earlier, more simple. It just says a proto or pre-Germanic root called Kli, K-L-I. And what it points to, both Edom Online and OED point to as cognate with cleave, are words like clam, climb, and clay.
Of course. Okay.
And so the idea of that, the cl in cleave, and interestingly enough, possibly the GL in stuff like glue and glutinous, there may be a connection there, but that idea of being sticky and to climb, you're sort of sticking to the wall or whatever, hopefully. And so that's...
Dude, if you're not sticking to the wall, then it's called falling.
That's not, yeah, well, fair enough. That's a whole different word. I found the clam interesting. This clam, I guess, you could think of it in both senses of cleave. But the divide split side of things, we get the Old English cleofan, C-L-E-O-F-A-N. And that comes from Old High German cleoban or chleoban or whatever. C-H-L-I-O-B-A-N. And that goes back to a Pi root that everyone agrees exists that is transliterated with English letters G-L-E-U-B-H. Gleuv, maybe? I'll ask Mark next time I'm talking to him.
Pi really is fucking with us when it comes to the pronunciations, isn't it?
Yeah, it totally is.
Sometimes I feel like I'd like to hear someone read a Pi dictionary aloud just because it would be so glorious to hear those weird amorphous noises.
Yeah, it really would be. The cognates with cleave on the divide split side of things were interesting. So it gives us it's cognate with clever and with clove, as in a garlic clove. And of course, you get that's
also
where you get
as
like
a cloven hoof.
Yeah, exactly. Cloven hoof is a hoof that's been literally split. It has a split down the middle. And glyph, and other associated like hieroglyphics and stuff, but glyph comes from the Greek word carve. So you're marking like a split in something to make the letter, to make the glyph.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So that was kind of cool. And Smith also had a very cool paragraph on cleave. Interestingly enough, Smith only has cleave in synonyms discriminated in the older sticking to slash with sense. It doesn't show up in any sort of divide split section, which doesn't necessarily mean that it didn't, obviously doesn't mean that it didn't have that meaning in frequent use then. But it's interesting. It was interesting to me that it wasn't there. But as always,
I think Smith's just the kind of guy who prefers a 10th century word to a 12th century word.
I think that's probably right.
That's pretty clear.
It's probably the way it goes. So his entry on cleave is, the things he's discriminating with cleave are cleave and adhere and stick. And so he says, cleave is to adhere at all parts of an extended surface. It was of more frequent use formerly than at present, being now more commonly employed in a moral sense of personal attachments or to the persistent entertainment of hopes and opinions. Adhere is used as a close and persistent as used of a close and persistent maintenance of the same matters. In its physical sense, it implies such superficial contact as tends naturally or by the inherent properties of the substances themselves to unite them, as wax adheres to fingers. Stick is the most familiar familiar and comprehensive of the three, and is used as the others are, that is, of both material and moral subjects, in their secondary meanings, as cleave expresses persistency of affection, and adhere persistency of principle, so stick belongs to mental application and resolve.
Oh, Smith.
And again, I don't care if he's right or wrong. It just sounds neat.
I mean, I feel like I agree, but I might just be agree because I love the way he says. I might just agree. Oh, dear.
This is why.
What's happened to the words?
Morning recording sessions.
I should point out, you know, the more kind of keen temporally aware listeners will have perhaps considered that there is a 5-hour time difference between Ryan and I. And so while Ryan is having a super early morning, I'm not.
Hey,
I just had a really, really late night last night. It is indeed the crack of noon. And I had a very lovely evening yesterday where a friend came over for a beer because that's something we're allowed to do again, which is lovely. And then my husband and I sat up drinking beer and listening to the new Gillian Welch Dave Rollins album. And I was caused to remark upon the brilliant Kurt Vonnegut sentiment that he expresses in several different places. But I believe it comes from, I believe it was his uncle who used to say, if this isn't nice, I don't know what is.
Hmm.
So it was a very, very pleasant evening, but the pleasant evening ran on till about 3 a.m., so I'm too old to stay up to that time these days, especially when there's been beer drinking going on. So forgive me and my not very good command of the words today. I am do agree, yes.
I am do be agree. So there's cleave. It's not actually one word. It's just two words. It's two words disguised
as
that have been cleaved together or cloven together.
Ah, that's.
But I have cloven them apart.
That's so great. Yeah, it's never occurred to me that a clove of garlic is a split.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
It's actually, it hasn't until that very moment when I said it. It's never occurred to me that clove and cloven are related. Like, they're not related, they're the same. But
yeah, exactly.
I just hadn't put those two things together in my brain, yeah. Cool. Yeah, I like that a lot. The whole contronyms cool thing does hurt my brain a little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was saying that my husband's been learning German, and when it comes to learning any language, I think you sort of start off on this, like, imagine someone, like, setting off along a mountain path, and they're, like, you know, step after step, enjoying the scenery, encountering things that are pretty usual and expected, and then suddenly, like, you know, a TV crashes out of the ether and lands on the path in front of you. It's like you go so long going, oh yeah, this is language learning, this seems cool, I understand, and then suddenly you get to a point where you're like, what just happened? And
yeah
so I've completely forgotten why I started to talk about this now. Oh, yes. Oh, dear. It's the bad words again. So things like, oh, there are two words. Well, but they're the same word. Oh, no, but they're actually completely different.
Oh, yeah.
They mean the same, but they mean different. What?
I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. Cool.
Yeah. So there you go.
Okay. I like that a lot. So, I am going to talk about future.
Oh, nice.
Future. Future. It's interesting because I feel like it's a word with almost magical properties. Because it makes you, like, we're quite keen on saying, I love the future. And what we usually mean by that is, technology is awesome. It's so much better that we can do things like this now than the way we used to do them. And I think that this sense of living in the future has, I mean, certainly for people like us who grew up when we grew up.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know about you, but I am still a little bit disappointed that we don't have flying cars yet.
Oh, endlessly, yeah.
Like, I feel like flying cars were, they were supposed to be, it's 2020, for goodness sake.
That's, as
no?
a kid,
2020.
I just had this conversation with my 11-year-old. As a kid myself, there are several things that have been huge disappointments as I grew into a reluctant, ravaged by the forces of time adult. And among those, chief among those, are the lack of flying cars and an almost total mm-hmm. absence of grappling hooks in my life. And I just... Although I will say this, I thought quicksand was going to be a much bigger problem for me than it turned out to be. Like something about the 80s...
The grappling hook thing.
Quicksand was supposed to be everywhere, which would probably necessitate the use of much more grappling hooks. But I've never seen quicksand in my entire life. Nor have I really had opportunity to use a grappling hook. Nor have I ever driven a flying car. So I'm rethinking this whole living in the future is
awesome
thing.
I always feel with the grappling hook thing, it's one of these things that you see in films and TV shows and things like that. And I always think they produce the grappling hook from somewhere, because those things can't be easy to carry.
No.
You know, they're sharp. They're basically all made out of sharp. So what do you keep them in a case? Are they like in a little chainmail bag that makes sure that they don't just grapple the shit out of everything they come into contact with? So anyway, they produce them, and then someone expertly wields the rope swing, you know, sort of mechanism, and then they hit the thing that they want to hit every single time.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm quite glad that there haven't been many grappling hooks in my life, because I feel like my ability to coordinate all of those actions successfully, I feel like I might be lacking.
That's fair enough. The people that I'm around most of the time, it's probably a fairly low percentage of those people that I would really want wielding grappling hooks on a regular basis. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess fair enough.
Yeah. I do have a friend who could almost certainly make a grappling hook.
That's handy.
You know, he's spent his lockdown making all kinds of things. Out of all kinds of yeah, that's a whole podcast on its own.
Neat. But anyway, back to the future.
So, back to the future, nicely done. And I was hoping that we would get a chance to talk about one of my most treasured film viewing memories in the 80s, growing up watching those films. And, you know, if we have our hopes pinned on flying cars, then I don't think that we can discount the role of Back to the Future in those expectations.
No.
So the OED defines the word future, the adjective and the noun, as that is to be or will be hereafter.
Oh,
often
I like
qualifying
it.
A noun. Yeah, me too. Often qualifying a noun with the sense the person or thing that is expected to be whatever the noun denotes. So the earliest citation that we get for this sense of the word is around about 1374, in Chaucer's Troilus and Crusade, future time, ere I was in the snare, could I not seen? And we then get this, the next citation given, I want to just draw attention to this because it made me laugh and think about my evening yesterday. So from around about 1440, from the Gesta Romanorum, and the quotation says, vinegar was good, and that is for the preterite time. Wine is good, and that is for the present time, and must shall be good, and that is for the future time.
Nice.
Now, this is lovely for a whole lot of reasons. I enjoy talking about tripartite things and rhetorical tricolons and such like. All of my students, they always say, why do you call it that fancy name? We never call it that. But if you can't talk about rhetorical tricolons in an English class, then what's going on in the universe?
Yeah.
So I like this sense of vinegar, wine and must. But also the word preterite just doesn't get enough usage as far as I'm concerned. And I felt as though I'd heard this word before, but I couldn't really place when I'd heard it before, which is sort of hilarious because it means past. It just means referring to the past.
Yeah.
And I eventually realised that it harks back to my time spent as a an organist in the Scottish Anglican Church, where they use quite interesting but sometimes quite archaic language. And I'm sure that I've come across preterite in a church sense, and probably in that particular church sense.
Right.
So I like this idea of past, present and future, you know, that they often come together. It makes sense.
Yeah.
If you're thinking about one, you're generally thinking about the other two. And the description of wine was kind of nice. So it comes from the OED says Old French and French futur, F-U-T-U-R, or future with an E for the feminine, Latin futurus, future participle of esse, to be. And then it says, see be verb etymology. Now, the wonder that is the internet and being able to click on a link to the very place that gives you the answers to the question that you just had while reading the words that you read, that's one of my favourite things about the future. I am a human being with questions, always. And sometimes those questions pop into my head at the most inconvenient times.
Yeah.
So the fact that I can read something like that and then just click and find the answer to my question, God bless the future.
It is the best.
However, if you have quite a bit of time and quite a strong interest in etymology, morphology, language, semantics, syntax, all kinds of super complicated things, and unless you are a much better qualified person than I am, if you are very comfortable with the notion of reading quite a long thing full of stuff that you don't understand, have a look at the etymology section in the OED for the verb be. It's massive and it's kind of wonderful. So the futurus, the part of the Latin verb to be that gives us the word future, is itself, it's one of those, you know, sofa landing on the mountain path out of nowhere kind of features of language. So the Latin verb to be says that the principal parts of the verb are given as sum, esse, and straight away you're like, oh, okay, they're the same verb, but they don't look very much like each other, sum and esse. You wouldn't relate those two words. The
right.
next part is fui, F-U-I, which again looks completely different. You're like, oh, odd. And then the last part is futurus. Now, students of Latin, students of pretty much any language, when they come up against any part of the verb to be, usually do a bit of head scratching and then they start to look this stuff up. And then they get into that point with language learning where you think the entire universe is just fucking with me. Like, how can this possibly be? And what I discovered while I was checking out how this happens and why this happens is that there's a name for it. It's called suppletion. And what Wikipedia has to say about suppletion, in linguistics and etymology, suppletion is traditionally understood as the use of one word as the inflected form of another when the two words are not cognate. For those learning a language, suppletive forms will be seen as irregular or even highly irregular. The term suppletion implies that the gap in the paradigm was filled by a form supplied by a different paradigm. Instances of suppletion are overwhelmingly restricted to the most commonly used lexical items in a language. So there are a few things to take from this. First of all, what?
Like, that was my main takeaway.
I thought there were rules to this sort of thing. Well, you're telling me that you're just going to like, okay, we want to make this word fit a pattern and a set of rules and a grid or a table. Oh, but we have a gap, so let's just put another word in there. Is that word going to be related to the word that we're filling up with the rest of the grid? No. We'll just put in another word. It's fine.
No one will notice.
It's good. But also, instances of suppletion are overwhelmingly restricted to the most commonly used lexical items in a language. Like, so are we going to do this for the words that hardly anybody's going to be using? No. Let's do it for the ones that people use all the damn time.
Just use a little frog DNA. What could go wrong?
So yeah, this sum esse fui futurus represents, I think, the great paradigm of frustration that comes from learning a language. When you get yourself into that mode of thinking that languages actually follow rules.
Because, yeah, it's ridiculous.
As we know, a lot of the time, they just don't.
You ancient linguists were so preoccupied with whether or not that you could, you didn't stop to think if you should.
Well, there is a very, very lovely, there's a very, very lovely entry in the OED, a very lovely part in the entry for the OED future definition that I am going to find in just a moment. Sometime in the future.
Yeah.
It is nice. The other thing I like about the future is that it never has any... There's no fixed time to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the future. And so is this.
It's very non-committal.
And so is this. Yeah. So, we get to sense four of the word future given by the OED. And there's a citation from 1881 from a work called New Phrynichus by Rutherford. Ooh. And it says... I know. It says, it affords the necessary authority to supply deponent futures to a group of verbs, of which by a singular fatality, no future form has been preserved. And wow. I love this. This is like suppletion in action. So wow. We have these words and we want to use them and we want to teach people about them and we want other people to use them. But actually, gaps, you know, just... terms in the table that we just can't fill in. Yeah. So, well, let's just make some up.
Just, yeah.
I also very much like which by a singular fatality no future form has been preserved. It kind of makes me imagine that there was a messenger carrying all that information and unfortunately something sticky happened to that messenger and all those futures were, by a singular fatality, just they were gone.
We had compiled them all in one book carried by one guy who was then eaten by a bear. Damn it.
Yeah, and you know, you may as well speculate that because who knows what the future holds.
Oh, nice.
So, aside from messengers being eaten by bears and the great frustration of language learning, Etym Online has to add that Latin futurus, going to be or yet to be, is the irregular suppletive future participle of esse to be. This is what led me to suppletive. And it's from a pirate, a very interesting pirate. And the reason that it's very interesting is because it means to be, to exist, or to grow. And those are interesting concepts in any language. I think those are interesting concepts because until you have a word to talk about those things, are you even really able to think and communicate? It's bringing me back to I think, therefore I am.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the inverse is true, I am, therefore I think, first you have to know that you are. First you have to have that sense of being. So this pirate... B-H-E-U-E, boo. I might as well make that noise because I don't know what the correct noise would be. However, that's what I'm going to go for.
Yeah.
And because I can. It has such a wonderful list of cognates. It really made me happy. You know, sometimes you click on a pirate on Etym Online and you go, heh. And sometimes you go, ooh.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
That was definitely, it's definitely the latter rather than the former. So it forms all or part of... This is a long list, but I'm going to read it all because it's great.
Okay.
Bauhaus, B.
Nice.
Beam, as in a beam of light. Boer, as in the Boer War. Mm-hmm. Bondage, boodle, boom. Boer, booth, band. Bower, bowery, build. Bumpkin, busk, bustle. Bayer, bylod. Eisted fod, euphues. Fiat, forebear, future. Husband, imp, monophysite, neighbour, neophyte, phyletic, philo, phylum, phylogeny, physic, physico, physics, physio, physique, fight as a suffix, phyto, and symphysis.
Man.
There are some super cool words in that list.
Yeah.
Even if you were just saying here is an amorphous group of words, there's some cool words within that list. But all of these words come from this single proposed pi root. There are a few that I wanted to just take some time to zoom in on because they were really interesting. So boodle caught my attention straight away because it wasn't a word that I knew. Etymonline gives the meaning of boodle from 1833 as crowd, from 1858 as phony money, especially graft money, actual or potential. And this is American English slang. And either or both are based on bundle or from the Dutch word boedel, meaning property or riches, which is from Proto-Germanic bothla, from the Pi root boo, to be, exist or grow. Because in order to be, exist or grow, you have to have some sort of commodity that allows you to do that.
Yeah.
That's quite lovely. I enjoyed that one.
That is interesting.
We then have, now this word really caught my eye because Eisteddfod is one of the very, very small number of Welsh words where I actually know what it means.
Oh, cool.
And it's so unusual to find Welsh pop up in the etymology of English words that I got quite excited about that. So Eisteddfod, which has a capital E, E-I-S-T-E-D-D-F-O-D, is an annual assembly of Welsh bards. Now,
oh, that's cool.
If word nerds, you're listening to this podcast and the idea of an assembly of Welsh bards doesn't make you say, oh, that's cool, maybe we are not your people.
Yeah, I'm not sure how you're still here. I don't get
it. Yeah, have you? Are you lost?
Wow.
I mean, I don't know what an assembly of Welsh bards would get up to, but I feel like I want to know.
Oh, yeah. And I'm coming too.
Yeah, if they'll let me in, I'm there. And what the word Eisteddfod actually means, it literally means a sitting. So Eisted means to sit, from sed, which means sit, and is also from a Pi root, and bod, to be, from this thin Pi root boo. So an Eisteddfod, which is an assembly of Welsh bards, literally means to sit and be.
Oh, that's cool.
And yeah, I like that. I like that one a lot. So we then get to imp, which it's the only entry in the alphabetical list for I, but also it looks nothing like any of those words in the list. And so I was curious about that one too. And it comes from Old English imp or impa, which means a young shoot or a graft, from impian, meaning to graft, probably an early Germanic borrowing from vulgar Latin, from late Latin impotus, meaning implanted. And eventually you can take this all the way back to bu, which means to be, exist or grow. So an imp is a little offshoot, the offspring or the child.
Like
and it became, from about the 1580s, this sense of a little devil, the offspring or a graft or a root of Satan. But it's also a very pleasing word to say. So I was interested to see that imps are things that haven't grown too much. Then we have physics. I'm currently interested in physics because I'm taking an online course in kinesiology. And I didn't do any physics at school. I did 2 weeks. It's a long story. But the 2 weeks, that was enough. I went, scurried back to Latin where I belonged. And because I'm learning about movement, obviously physics is relevant and important, and I'm finding myself very much trying to catch up with physics. However, what interested me in this entry, Etymonline has physics as, from the 1580s, natural science, the science of the principles operative in organic nature, from physic in the sense of natural science. And then it says this, also see ix.
Ix.
Now, ix, the suffix dash ics. And there is an entry on Etymonline for this suffix. And as we've seen, like when you looked at empty, it's so exciting when you can find one of these little word tools that does so much with so few letters. And Ix, which Etymo Online defines or talks about in the names of sciences or disciplines like acoustics or aerobics or economics, a 16th century revival of the classical custom of using the neuter plural of adjectives with Greek ikos, pertaining to mean matters relevant to. And then there's an even better one. See, ik. An even smaller suffix. So this takes us to Middle English ik, ik or ick, word-forming element making adjectives, having to do with, having the nature of, being made of, caused by, or similar to. From French, ik, and directly from Latin, ikus, or from cognate Greek, ikos, in the manner of, pertaining to. This in itself comes from a pi adjective suffix, iko, which gives us things like Slavic isku, and the ske, that often forms the end of Russian names, Russian surnames.
Yeah.
And it's used in chemistry to indicate a higher valence than names in us, O-U-S. So it's the one that's given here is benzoic. So you could have benzoous, and then you could have benzoic.
Right.
And in Middle English and after, often spelled I-C-K, I-K-E, and I-Q-U-E. Variant forms were common in early modern English and survived in English dictionaries into early 19th century. This spelling was supported by Johnson, but opposed by Webster, who prevailed. I do like to think,
Webster.
My brain tells me that Johnson and Webster didn't have a sword fight over which spelling should exist. But I kind of want to believe that that might have been the case. I know that they didn't exist at the same time in history, but, I do like to think that spelling wars might have been a thing once.
Absolutely.
So, two tiny little letters with all of this rich etymology going on. I found that really quite exciting.
Yeah, that's very
the last
cool.
word in the boo pie cognate list is a word that I really, really love because it just doesn't look like any other words that I know, and it's the word symphysis. It's S-Y-M-P-H-Y-S-I-S. And symphysis is a word that I'm familiar with because of studying anatomy. And the best known symphysis is the pubic symphysis, which is the joint at the centre of the two halves of the pelvis, where the front of the pelvis joins.
Okay.
And the Etymo Online calls it a union of bones from the 1570 medical Latin, from Greek symphysis, a growing together or union. So we get this from syn, as in together, and physis, growth, from the pi root bu, to exist or be or to grow. And yeah, a symphysis is a joint that allows for very, very little movement. So it's almost a fusion, but not quite. So I like the sense of the bones having grown together. It's quite nice. And more noises. Pie noises are they're always good. It gives us all of these words and so many more. Back to the future for a moment.
Yes.
Something exciting happened while I was looking at this word. I certainly found it exciting. I found that there used to be a verb form, future, and this obsolete verb meant to, you would use it as in to make future, meaning to put something off for a future day. We get a citation from 1642, and who knows but that therefore God hath futured other hopes and frustrated other means to the intent that he might honour this ordinance.
I like
and
that
then 1646. Yeah, so they trifle, and by futuring, fool away their own salvation. This sense of if you spend too much time in the future, it'll affect your present day quality of life. But yeah, I mean, we're both futurers, aren't we? We both like to put things off to another time. Yeah.
It sounds much better than procrastinators too. I'm not procrastinating. I am futuring this.
Yeah, I'm just going to future that. But the super duper exciting thing, you know, obsolete usages, they happen quite frequently in the rich and tapestried history of the English language. But what I found at the very bottom of the entry for future in the OED is draft editions, June 2017. The word future isn't done yet in terms of its etymology. And so the draft edition, in its own little category, I'd never seen this before in the OED, so I found this quite exciting. It refers to, it's a term used in tennis, originally in American tennis, in plural as futures. The OED defines it, it's just given as a note. It isn't there as a full entry yet because it's a draft edition. A tennis tournament played by amateurs or lower-ranked professional players. Now specifically, sometimes with a capital initial, a series of tournaments organised by the International Tennis Federation representing the lowest level of competition in men's and women's professional tennis. Also, any of the individual tournaments or matches in this series. It's often attributive, and in its earliest use was attributive, as the Futures Circuit or Futures Tournament. It's called this because the tournaments are intended to bring on and encourage potential top-level players. The first, there are four citations given for this use of the word futures. The first is from 1969, from the Amarillo, Texas Sunday News Globe, which announces City High School Futures Tennis Tournament, Caprock Courts at 2 p.m. And then by 1975, we see in the New York Times, the Women's Tennis Association and United States Tennis Association have set up a 10-stop, $100,000 futures circuit. The idea is to give second echelon players a shot at competitions and money. And then the latest, again in the New York Times, in 2015, I was playing a futures in Romania. So it really pleased me to think that the word, which means that which is to come, is still evolving, changing, being used in different ways, to the extent that it's the very existence of this usage is still just a draft edition, as if the OED are waiting to see what will be before they include it.
Nice. Love it.
Fantastic. Futures.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
As another word, it's like, I really like it when you say the word you're going to do, and I go, I have absolutely no idea what's about to happen because I can't even think of, you know, sometimes it's like, I don't think we've had one where maybe Petrichor, where I knew what it meant. And so I vaguely knew where it came from, but not that I knew the whole story too, but there's sometimes you kind of say it and be like, I'm immediately kind of going, oh, I wonder if it's this or I wonder if it's this. And then there's other ones where you say, I'm looking at this today. And I kind of go, okay. Huh. Because I have no starting point. But that's very cool. I like that a lot.
I think given that I'm in a slightly hungover, not quite sure what time of day it is state, that sense of I have no idea what you're going to say is particularly strong today.
It's fantastic. Very cool.
But yeah, I did enjoy future. Future awesome. With a little side tour into Latin, suppletion, the what the fuckery of learning languages, and then a set of tennis tournaments.
And that's it for another episode of Lexitecture. To get in touch with us about something you heard in this episode, you can email us at words@lexitecture.com. You can also follow along and talk to us at Lexitecture on Facebook and Twitter, and at Lexitecture Podcast on Instagram. For back episodes and the occasional blog post, visit us at lexitecture.com. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you again soon.